Hello, and welcome to what will be, as Ryan mentioned, my last official Morning Energy Live. I'm your host, Andrew Gillick, and today I have the distinct pleasure of sitting down with Will Van Lo, founder of Quantum, one of the most successful energy-focused private equity franchises of the last generation. Will founded Quantum in 1998 and leads its investment strategy and capital allocation process, serving as chair of the firm's executive and investment committees. Before launching Quantum, he co-founded Windrock Capital and earlier worked in energy investment banking at Kidder Peabody and Nations Bank. He earned his BA in finance from TCU and has served in charitable roles, including boards associated with Baylor College of Medicine and MD Anderson Cancer Center. Will, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
All right. Also, so before we start, just have a little fun, ask you a couple questions so the audience can get to know you a little better. All right.
Perfect.
All right. So, Will, what was the first concert you ever went to?
Before I answer that, I do want to just say thank you to Denver. You guys are amazing partners. Most in the room, I'm sure, know that. But, Andrew, you work for a great firm, I guess. you guys are great partners, so really excited to be up here.
I appreciate that.
First concert, Jimmy Buffett.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
A lot of parrot heads here? No? Definitely not.
And it was in college. I didn't go to a concert until I was in college, so my parents wouldn't let me go as a kid.
I understand that. I have similar parents. All right, what's the best advice you ever got from a grandparent, if appropriate?
I actually never got great advice from a grandparent because I didn't really know my grandparents growing up. But I think the best advice I ever got was probably from my my high school youth pastor. Odd place to get advice for a business guy, but actually a good place. And he gave me two pieces of advice. He said, always treat other people like you want to be treated. And number two, if you want to be understood, seek first to listen before you're understood. So understand somebody else before you seek to be understood. So he used to always tell me, God gave you two ears and one mouth and use them in that proportion. Pretty good advice.
I agree. Listening's hard sometimes.
It is very hard.
All right, next. Have you been to more states or more countries?
More states. I raise capital for part of my job, and I think I've been to 48 states.
And maybe we need to, maybe 2026 is the year for.
I don't think there's much money in the other two, so that's probably right. I've been to.
Sorry, North Dakota.
South Dakota, actually.
What is the most interesting object in your office?
That's a tough one. I've got a lot of objects in my office, but I think probably the most interesting one that gets a lot of, like, why do you have that, is I have an 8-foot tall longboard, surfboard in my office. And it was a gift that a chairman of an investment bank gave me we get lots of stock back when we do a lot of these sales in public companies. And we did a really big block trade. I think it was their biggest block trade they ever did. And he's a big avid surfer. So he had this surfboard custom made for me. And the only reason it's sitting there, I mean, it is kind of cool. I guess it's a deal toy, but I have no clue how to get it out. So it sits there.
I feel like that's a much better question when, like, we can see the surfboard.
There you go.
It's
quite
for the future. All right. And now the last question, to really get to know you, what's the best sandwich?
gosh, I'm more of a salad guy, but I'm going to say it's a hamburger in Chileno Bay in Cabo, Mexico, which you wouldn't necessarily think about hamburgers in Mexico being great, but
this
they
is a good
actually
one.
Really
All
are
right.
very good.
We'll have to try it out. We'll write that down. Well, thank you very much, Will. This is good. All right, so now let's hop into it, but maybe we'll start with, what's the Will Van Lo origin story? You started Quantum in 1998. Why energy? Why then? And really what I want to know is, why is there only one L in Will? Was it a typo at the hospital or?
You can blame my German and Dutch heritage, Wilbert, not William. So if I would have had English great-great-great-grandparents, it would probably have been two L's. But
mystery solved.
So that's that.
Okay.
Quantum is really kind of just a cool story how it came about. I was in my early career was an investment banker. On Wall Street, did a few years of that, and actually started my own boutique bank in 1994, and got to know all six of the private equity firms that did energy private equity back in the early 90s. And one of the things I realized was, pretty much most people thought about oil and gas is underground real estate, just buying PDP, levering up, cutting costs, paying down debt. And there was one group, it was a group part of Enron Capital and Trade, part of Enron, and I had a bunch of geologists and engineers in their group. And, you know, they were the only group that would really look at development projects and, you know, infill drilling or water floods or 3D seismic. And, you know, I realized quickly taking companies around to these six groups that, you know, that on a risk-adjusted basis, actually you could earn a lot better returns doing some of that than just supposed to buying assets. So as there was not very much capital doing that, and the industry needs it. And so, you know, we set about starting a new private equity firm that was going to be much more focused on developing and actually even exploring for oil and gas, as opposed to, you know, clearly buy PDPs, that's a great business. But that was really the genesis of it. It was just saw a need, saw an opportunity, was a very young entrepreneur and had built a successful investment bank and got to know the competition, know what they were really good at and what maybe they weren't as good at, and found a niche or an opening to start a firm.
It's been quite a run as Energy's, you know, gone through its cycles, and here we are today. And you guys, Quantum, you sit right at the intersection of electrons and molecules, and that's obviously more than we have time to talk about in one session here. But maybe considering your most recent high-profile exit, Cogentrix to Vistra, why don't we start there? I feel like 15 months is a little short for a holding period in PE these days, but that IR probably looks pretty good right now. Can you tell us a little bit about the deal?
Sure. And it was actually 12 months. So we closed it in January of 25, and we announced the sale here on January 5th of 2026. So I think, you know, one of the things we've always been very big in is understanding the entire kind of value chain, right? So all the way from, you know, call it the wellhead to the burner tip. And so, you know, we started the firm in 98 doing just oil and gas and midstream, but over time evolved into oil field services and power, initially thermal power back in 2010, got into renewables in 2017. So really have kind of done almost everything imaginable in energy, not refining, actually. We've not done a refining deal. But and I would say we've also kind of been on the front end and actually in partnership with you guys on a lot of things with AI and machine learning, using data analytics in the oil and gas space. And I think because of that, and we were, you know, as we were kind of building out a lot of our AI infrastructure and tools, we realized that this AI thing is going to be really big, right? And the other thing we realized was, you know, this LNG wave is going to be really big, and we had a market that had been basically flat. Electrical demand had been flat in the U.S. for a very long time, and just given what we were doing with LNG at the time, with data science, you know, I think we maybe saw just a little bit earlier than some, you know, this pending demand growth in electricity, and when we looked at the, you know, the current stock of assets out there, we realized that, you know, power plants, thermal power plants, we're trading at a massive, massive discount to replacement value, for good reason. but we felt like that reason was about to change. And so we saw deep value, the ability to go out and buy something, you know, significantly below its intrinsic value, its replacement cost, very strong cash flow. And if we were right, in 3 to 5 years, we could make a lot of money. We just, it happened to happen in 12 months.
A little faster.
3 to 5 years.
So, is this the fastest repricing of power that you've ever seen in your career?
It's the only repricing of power I've seen in my career. And it tells you a lot. I mean, if you look at the stock of private power plant, if you look at, you know, who owns the private equity that owns thermal power in this country, almost every one of them other than I think ArcLight has sold, right? You know, there's been over $50 billion of power plants get sold in the last 12 months. And so I think everybody that's been in this space, one, it's been a tough space, and two, they did reprice, and everybody wanted to, you know, it's kind of like the old saying in the exploration, you know, business, God, just give me one more boom, and I promise I won't screw it up. And I think this was the only boom that most of the people in power had ever seen.
So they had to go for it.
They had to go for it, yep.
Exit. And so, yeah, I guess, you know, we're going to continue to see how it plays out over you know, the next few years, and if all that power demand really materializes, yep, that people are expecting from AI. And so, you know, as we continue to discuss this power demand, and we're seeing hyperscalers rushing to build a lot of the behind the meter solutions. And so do you think, as you think about the hyperscaler strategy, that they're gonna go further back down the value chain, you know, past, you know, just building power behind the meter to actually owning gas in the ground, or is the PPA gonna be just fine?
Well, I think you just gotta start with these hyperscalers. Their service they're providing basically is compute power, right? And they know that they're not energy experts. They don't really even wanna mess with that if they don't have to, but they're having to. And so, you know, because really, literally, power is the lifeblood of these data centers. Without it, they don't work. And you can, you know, go put tens of billions of dollars investment in the ground. If you don't have power, it's you know, it's idle. Can't get any value out of it. So I think they'll do as little as they have to do. I don't actually think you'll see them go on reserves. That's like would be pretty idiotic. It's a very complicated industry, and it's one thing to go put some, you know, reciprocating, you know, engines out there for backup, or maybe even build a on-prem, you know, behind the meter power plant, or tie into some solar power with batteries. But I don't think they want to own reserves. So not going to go that far upstream.
Yeah.
That said, I do think you could see, you know, more long-term contracting where they, you know, maybe tie up, you know, with a large creditworthy counterparty, a 20-year supply of gas or FT to make sure they can get that gas to their power plant to run their data centers. They want assurance of service. They want to make sure that there is electrons available, you know, 99.99999% of the time.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like over the last 18 months we started hearing about, wait, why is Amazon trying to trade gas? Why are some of the hyperscalers trying to figure out like what's going on in this marketplace? And I think your observation of it's a little more complicated for them to get all the way owning the reserves makes sense, but yeah, securing all the places along the value chain they can, like with a long-term gas agreement, that I guess that kind of makes sense.
And not having, I mean, like, you know, we in this latest winter storm y'all are having up here, it's very cold, but like our power plants in ISO New England, I mean, you know, we were buying gas at, you know, triple digits. And I think they look at that and say, well, I mean, overall, energy is a pretty small component of the overall cost of these data centers. But if you start talking about $100 gas and you can't even get it, then that's a whole different issue, right? The real cost becomes much bigger.
So if AI and data center load is driving the power narrative today, like what's the sober version of the narrative? Like what's real, what's hype? Like where's the timeline mismatch? I mean, is you know, power demand gonna continue to grow at this rate that we haven't seen in a long time, or is AI gonna sort of train itself to not use as much power? Or how do you see the next couple of years?
You know, I would say it's hard to tell what's hype and what's real today. There's clearly hype, right? Anytime you have an industry mobilizing hundreds of billions of dollars of capital on an annual basis, getting invested, I mean, there's gonna be hypesters come into the space. And so, you know, I personally believe that AI is certainly in the top three technologies humankind has ever invented, maybe the most important technology, or the most important invention of mankind. So I do think I don't think AI is a hype. I think AI is so real, and if you don't get that, you need to get that. But I do think that, you know, how much power we're actually gonna need, how much energy we're actually gonna need, we really don't know. I mean, I was had an opportunity to spend some time with one of the founders of one of the largest tech companies in the world. And he basically said, we need an infinite amount of power. I said, well, infinite's a lot. And he said, we need an infinite amount of power. We can consume whatever can be produced. And his point was, is the more power, the more compute we have, the more use cases we create, and people will use it as long as it's, you know, somewhat affordable.
Right.
But I think what we have to really think about, Andrew, is we do have to be careful in extrapolating kind of a hockey stick, which is what we kind of have now.
Yeah.
Because the chip technology will get a lot more efficient. I mean, if you just look at the latest chips that have been announced from NVIDIA, the Vera Rubin chips, I mean, those are, you know, depending on how you want to look at, somewhere between 5 and 10 times more energy efficient per token or compute, whatever you want to measure it by, than just the chips that came out last year, the Grace Blackwell chips. So, and if you go back 10 years, they're like 2,000 to 100,000 times more energy. So these chips are going to, and by the way, AI is going to be the biggest tool yet to get chip architecture better. So chips are going to get much more energy efficient, and the algorithms are going to get much more efficient. And so I just think probably if you just said with the use cases we currently know of and expect to have, we're overestimating energy demand. But I also wouldn't bet against some of these tech guys that say there's more use cases than you can ever imagine.
And I believe that too. I don't know what they are, but I guess we've just seen so many booms and busts in the commodity cycle. And you look back to when quantum first started early in the late 90s, early 2000s, and all the power demand that people were expecting from the internet, right? That
yep.
My favorite article to quote was from Forbes in 1999, and it said, the headline was dig more coal, the PCs are coming, right? And they thought that the internet would take 50% of the grid, and it didn't.
Well, and I'll tell you this, another thing, and some of y'all probably read about this recently, but one of the things like Elon Musk is talking about is putting data centers in space with massive solar arrays up there where you have the sun literally shines 24 hours a day, every day. There's no clouds, there's no storms. There's a little space debris that might mess them up. But the efficiency is magnitudinally larger.
You don't have to cool things.
Interestingly enough, that's what I said I was talking with another tech founder last week about this, and I made that comment. He said, actually, it's harder than you think to cool, even though it's absolute zero. It's okay. But you're right.
Yeah.
You do have to cool things. But I do think it's interesting because there's, all of a sudden you start thinking about if you could really do that. My argument is obviously, well, my gosh, moving all that payload to space that's a lot. These data centers are very large.
Probably need some rocket fuel, right?
You do, and it's natural gas is what they use. So, if anybody can do it, Elon can, right? He's got SpaceX, and he's a guy I would not bet against. So I think there's also some really disruptive technologies potentially coming.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the most interesting one I've heard of that could meaningfully change the game in terms of the need for terrestrial power.
That makes sense. And then as you see the U.S. also pushing for a nuclear program, we'll see how quickly that advances. And it not retiring all of our thermal plants at the pace that we had been before, trying to keep pace. So we'll see. I'm in your camp, though. I think the team thinks the same thing. Overestimates certainly in the near term for how much power we're going to need, and then time will tell. All right, let's switch gears a little bit. Quantum's made its name in shale. Today some may say we're in the twilight of shale. I may say that, and that all the good rock's been picked over, and it's no longer a wildcatter's game. So, do you agree with that? Where does PE play a role in the shale upstream business in this next phase of oil and gas?
I think it's fair to say it's no longer a wildcatter's game in the U.S. in the sense of we've discovered all the major shale plays we're going to discover. But that doesn't mean I think the sun is setting on shales, and it definitely doesn't mean I think the sun's setting for private equity in shales. As we've learned many times over the years, is never underestimate technology, right? And even in the best shale plays, your recovery factors are still pretty low, so there's still a lot of gas and even more oil left in those formations. But I also think it's not so much today about taking the technology we applied to shale and reapplying it to new shale plays. I think it's actually taking that technology and applying it, going back to the conventional plays, and especially the tighter part. Those fields didn't just end, they just got uneconomic, many of these large, massive fields, right? And so I think the ability to go back and utilize that technology, we're doing that, for example, in many areas in the Rockies right now, in the Piceance and the Uinta, and we're getting extraordinary results using multi-stage frack technology on vertical wells, but where you got 4,000 to 6,000 foot of vertical column, right? So I think there's those opportunities. I think technology will continue to reinvent opportunities, whether it be for refracts or redrills. It's also a price game. You give me a high enough price, we'll go infill every shale well in America. And But the other thing I think the opportunity is Shell's not just distributed in the United States of America and Canada. I mean, it's distributed throughout the world. I mean, there's a lot of source rock that I think a lot of these foreign countries are now looking to U.S. technology, expertise, know-how on how to help them develop those resources in their country. So I think there's an incredibly bright future for both private companies, private capital, both domestically in North America, but I think even more so, increasingly so, I guess I should say, internationally over the next 5, 10, 15 years.
So sort of U.S. tech or North American technology being adopted internationally. We're seeing it some places. We're hearing about some public operators moving. Are they in areas where you feel like the regime or the governance is suitable for private capital investment?
You know, I used to ask that question a lot, and I finally realized that I'm not so sure that the United States is a safe place to invest capital. I mean, seriously, you have a regime change every 4 years here. And, you know, you saw somewhere like, I would have never thought the UK was a dangerous place to invest capital, but they just woke up one morning, decided to tax away, windfall profits tax away, all the profits of the North Sea UK company. So so I think it's clearly there's everything in investing is a trade-off between risk and return. And geopolitical risk is a risk. It's a risk that oftentimes you can actually reasonably quantify. You can even insure to some degree in certain places. And typically, what I will say is the resources in these other countries is the underground risk is obviously almost always much less in a lot of these places. And so it's just a balance. It's finding that right place where, you know, you're getting compensated for the risk you're taking. We did a deal recently in the Republic of Congo, put over $1 billion in Republic of Congo. Now, if you would have asked me, like, when my team came to me and said, we want to do this deal, I said, you're crazy. Congo? And they said, well, there's a difference between the Democratic Republic of Congo and the Republic of Congo. I said, I'm not sure about that, but it's a great example, right? Yeah. I mean, just, and it's a great deal.
Are there direct flights?
I have no clue. I forbid our team to actually go and on the ground there. So,
all right.
But
So that sort of brings up an interesting point about how Quantum has been looking internationally. And I think you actually have a couple of companies that are offshore focused. Mm-hmm. Do you, as you think about the offshore opportunity versus onshore conventional, onshore shale, as you're sort of looking past North America, what's most appealing to you today, or is it? It depends.
I think the world is an amazing. I mean, there are just so many opportunities. I mean, and I assume by offshore you mean like Gulf of America and places like that, not necessarily foreign countries,
or both. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I mean, clearly we've got a huge business in the Gulf of America that we have this company we just brought on. I think they're four of the most prolific wells ever drilled in the Gulf.
We're gonna fact check that.
Four wells, yeah. That came from your data, so I hope it's right.
Then I'm sure it's correct, never mind.
But we brought on four wells producing 100,000 barrels a day, you know? So I still think there's a lot of opportunity left in the Gulf. I think Alaska is an incredibly opportunistic rich place. If we can ever figure out how to do things, Mexico's got so much resource, it's not even funny. And then you get into things like, you know, is Venezuela really going to open up? I don't know. I'm not sure I want to be the first guy in there. But a fast follower
okay.
For sure.
Yeah.
Andrew, I think one of the things is we've been really focused about the last 5 years thinking about how we evolve and grow our business international. Because, you know, really, 20 years ago, everything was going international, right? I mean, sure. The domestic industry was dead before shales came along.
Yeah.
We've kind of now gone back to the, you know, future, if you will, in a way, because the shales, as you said, are maturing,
right.
Not sunsetting. But there's tremendous opportunity all around the world.
One of the other sort of themes or topics that came through in last earnings and starting to again here is this secondary or tertiary recovery of shale wells, whether it's Oxy doing it with CO2 or Exxon using the proppant from the refiners and Chevron with some magic pixie dust they're dumping down. Do you see any of these technologies or processes helping go from, you know, 9% recoveries to 10, 12, 15%? Or is that not the focus of a private capital? That's more of like a big business kind of decision.
It's clearly the pioneers have to be the biggest companies, because it is a lot of risk involved in that. It's going to be costly. Do I think it's technically feasible? Absolutely. And so I do think, you know, it's people generally, you know, they always say that necessity is a mother invention, right? And I think as the shales start to plateau, especially oil starts to plateau in our country, I think these companies are going to have to figure out how do we unlock more resource. And the best place to look for oil and gas is in an oil and gas field.
Or the Permian.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we all know the capital availability has shrunk for oil and gas, especially over the last few years. We've watched, you know, fundraises go out and be successful, but not as many folks are able to do that or willing to do it in this environment. So is less private capital availability good for you or not so good for you? Like more competition or just aren't the right deals, or how do you think about that change?
Well, it's both, because from just a pure quantum standpoint, clearly having less competitors is a good thing. That means we get more opportunity to pick and choose the deals we want to do or don't want to do. But just like there's less private capital available from groups like Quantum for you all, there's less institutional limited partners that want to put capital in. So I spend a lot more time in an airplane on the road than I'd prefer to. Trying to find that capital to aggregate it so that we can invest in the sector. So that's not a good thing. But I do think the overall, the lack of capital is a very bad thing for humanity. You know, there was a narrative that developed, you know, back in the latter part of the 2010s that, you know, hydrocarbons are bad, you know, evil, blah, blah, blah. And I think, I mean, fortunately, that narrative is much more balanced today. I think we do realize that the progress that humanity's been able to make because of access to hydrocarbon energy is really what's propelled most of human advancement over the last 150 years. So, but I do think that it's bad for humanity that yes, capital is in short supply. I mean, the availability of capital in the private sector is down probably 75% of what it was pre-COVID. And in the public sector, same thing. I mean, there's so many people left for good reasons that the returns were so bad. But I still think there's a lot of skepticism, right? Is this time really different? You know, are you really going to maintain the discipline? Are you really going to maintain the focus on making money as opposed to growing resources and reserves and production? So
far, so good.
Yes.
Making progress. Yeah. But do you think that as a owner of private assets, you know, with private capital, as you look to exit, are there also less buyers that you like? Are the exits harder in this environment, or as you put companies together, the demand there for what you've created is so it doesn't matter?
So if you just look at just the number of buyers out there, just sheer, I mean, like the number of public companies in the last 6 or 7 years has dropped roughly in half, right? A lot of industry consolidation. But I think the way I'd answer that question is kind of a two-part answer. If you have quality assets, no, not at all, because that's something that is in very short supply. And so I think it's, you know, you got to have that focus on quality. It's something we've always talked about is, you know, we want to be, everybody says, I want to be in the top quartile assets or top decile. But by definition, top quartile means 75% of the assets don't fit that, right? And so I think if you're really disciplined and are good, you know, a lot of times we'll go buy things that on the surface, like when we buy them, they're not top quartile. They may not even be top 50 percentile. But we know because of our vast experience in the sector that there's a lot we can do. We can bring technology from other basins that we've been involved in to really unlock that rock. And so I think as long as you're really focused on developing sticks that are going to compete competitively for the universe. We've never not been able to sell an oil and gas asset ever. You know, I remember a few years ago I had our investors were saying, well, Will, what happens if during the life cycle, the 10-year life cycle of your fund, if there's no longer a bid for oil and gas assets? I mean, there would always be a bid, you know.
You might not like the bid.
And exactly, that's exactly right. Jeffrey Harris, one of my partners, says that. He's like, you know, you can always sell, you just may not like the price. And but I think, you know, we've proven, I mean, gosh, I think just in the last 5 years, I think we've been involved in over 25 billion of exits. We've sent over 17 billion of cash on LPs. We've just announced another 9 billion of exits here in the last, you know, 35, 40 days. You can absolutely, it's a very good market if you've got quality stuff. So that's never been an issue.
That makes sense.
And by the way, it's one of those industries that if you have to, you just blow it down, you cash flow it. And that's the nice thing about it. You can actually, even if the market did go away, I mean, the fail safe is, that's great. We'll produce it out.
Or you do a continuation fund. I heard those are a little popular these
days.
They're
very popular.
if you can get it done. Mm-hmm. All right, so you've also launched some credit funds, not just the equity funds. So is the best risk-adjusted return right now drilling the well or lending to the guy drilling the well?
So we launched our credit platform about 6 years ago. And it was really it was really two-tiered focus. One was to do we call structured capital. The other was to do actually senior lending. And the senior lending was to do, you know, the banks really were pulling back in COVID in a massive way. Now they're since back in. So I'd say that's really not that interesting to us anymore. The banks are very competitive there again. And so we don't want to provide that, you know, that the return they make is pretty de minimis. but the other part of our credit platform is really done, just kind of exploded. And it's really more structured capital. We go in and we partner with mainly public companies, some private companies. But you know, because of the massive focus today on returning capital to shareholders through buybacks and dividends, there's a lot of projects that these public companies can't actually invest. You know, most of them are reinvesting, you know, maybe 50 to 60% of their cash flow. But most of them are sitting home 40 to 50% of their cash flow. And so, you know, they've got these projects that fall lower on their tiering, or maybe it's their non-op, so it's lumpy, and they can't really budget for lumpiness. So we found a real sweet spot partnering with public companies in our structured capital business. Is it better or worse? It's all about capital is very efficient in how it prices.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we clearly get lower rates of return on that, but we're taking less risk. You know, we're not having to buy land. We don't have to put in the infrastructure. We don't have to pay G&A. So, you know, we're very happy to go put capital in great assets that are, you know, it's just a different risk-adjusted return.
Got it. That makes sense. So you're partnering with the public companies. They want the production. They don't have time to get to these assets. Is that it?
Or really just the budgets. I mean, because shareholders are demanding, you know, big buybacks and big dividends. And so they, you know, they got to be very intentional about where they got to force rank, you know, every project every year. Just a lot of stuff that doesn't make the cut. But we can come in and provide them capital to do that. And it's really, for a lot of them, it's the only way they can really grow, because it's really off balance sheet financing. So, but it's not
What could go wrong?
Well, I mean, actually, nothing has gone wrong yet, because it's truly like going into the big shale plays and drilling great wells. And they're all relatively great. Maybe it's a 40% rate of return well in the Permian instead of 140% rate of return. Still good for us.
Covers your.
I mean, it's all relative.
Now that makes sense. So you've seen the shale boom and bust a couple of times here in the last 20 years. What do you think? And now we're seeing this AI power boom, right? Mm-hmm. So these energy cycles. What do you think? One thing investors in the room are currently underestimating about the energy markets for the next 5 years.
I think geopolitical risk is probably being mispriced a little bit. Like, I mean, if you look around the world at kind of the craziness in the Middle East, you know, you got a war raging in continental Europe, you got a war raging in the Middle East, you've got, you know, China may go into Taiwan soon. I mean, if you just look at that, I think we're mispricing geopolitical risk today. But maybe the biggest thing the world's missing is, I think it's gotten, you know, in a sense, lulled to sleep by the success of the U.S. shale revolution. And it does not fully appreciate that, especially on oil, that the ability of the U.S. to basically, essentially, over the last 15 years, the U.S. has met almost 100% of the world's growth, right? The demand growth has been almost met entirely from the U.S. Now, some countries are up, some countries are down. Net, they're about zero growth. And the U.S. is, you know, we've tripled, more than tripled our liquids production. And so I do think when I go around, especially when I talk to people outside of the U.S., even in the U.S. But I think people just like, well, the U.S. will keep providing that growth. And if you think about it, Andrew, the only major expenditure for the average person in the world, if you go look at housing's always number one in most countries, numbers 3 through 5 in various orders are energy, food, education, and healthcare. Okay? 4 of the 5 of those, all of them except for energy, over the last 15 or 20 years have roughly doubled in price and what the consumer pays. Energy's fallen roughly in half. Okay? I think the world totally underappreciates the fact, one, what energy, the gift that it's given to the world in terms of keeping energy prices low, but also they're just assuming that's going to continue into the future.
Meaning still go lower or just
no, the production, the U.S. can just keep growing production.
Oh, right.
So the fact that we were able to do what we did, I mean, go back to the pre-oil shale.
Oh, yeah.
Oil, I mean, yes, oil in 08 popped up like close to 150. But let's just say it was a $100 commodity at the time. Today it's a $60, $50 commodity.
We've had some inflation since then.
And that's on inflation. Yeah. And that's not adjusted for inflation. So the point being, I think, if you say what I think the biggest thing the world's missing is just how incredibly powerful the U.S. shale revolution was in terms of keeping the global economies tamed, in terms of inflation tamed and things just working to offset significant inflation everywhere else. That's not going to happen anymore. And we're going to have a period. Energy's got to catch up. Energy is mispriced. Geopolitical risk is mispriced, and energy is mispriced.
So when you say the markets are too comfortable with everything that's going on in the world.
Yes.
And that
the U.S. is just going to keep on, you know, being the engine of growth that it's been.
I mean, I feel like crude prices would have to be, you know, in the 80s or 90s to see growth again. In the United States.
Agree with that.
Does that sound right?
And by the way, you know, your OPEC plus countries need prices up in that range to balance their budgets. I mean, there's a couple that can make it work in the 50s or even the 40s, but not very many.
Yeah.
And most of them need a much higher price for oil. The U.S. shale revolution, and that's one reason why in November 14, Saudi decided to drop the hammer on the U.S. shale business.
Yeah.
They wanted to kill it. And they realized they couldn't.
They did not succeed.
They didn't. But I mean, they're waiting for that day where the U.S. oil shale revolution runs out of steam, and they know it's coming.
Right, but like you said, never short an oil and gas engineer.
Yep.
Because they'll figure out a way to keep moving along. All right, so I've heard you, and you mentioned earlier today, you've talked about the energy transition a lot, both when energy transition was controversial, and as you alluded to now, where it's a little more balanced. What's the most honest way for you to describe what the energy transition is to someone who doesn't live in it every day?
Mm-hmm.
Is that not the right framework?
No, it's a perfect framework. I actually start by saying there's never been an energy transition in the history of mankind. I start there. The word transition implies we're moving away from something to something else. Okay, and the facts are that every year you get a few anomalies in there for wars or massive, you know, COVID or something like that. But every decade, the amount of energy consumed in the world not only goes up materially, but every form of energy usage goes up. So all we've done over time, you know, coal was a real big kind of that really enabled the Industrial Revolution to happen back in the 1840s, right? And then oil in the early 1900s with the invention of the automobile, natural gas in the 40s with the invention of the gas turbine, electricity, nuclear in the 60s, and then most recently renewables starting maybe 15 years ago in earnest. But so we've had a series of energy additions, but we've never had an energy transition. And so I start there, and then I just say, you know, once you understand that, like at some point, do I think we're actually going to crack the code on fusion? Probably. I'm not sure when, I think you have to understand it's an increasing higher probability with AI than it's ever been.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So don't underestimate that. But until we crack the code for fusion, we're going to need more of all of the above every year, because you've got global populations going to continue growing. We're going to have another 2 billion people by 2050. You're going to have 1.5 to 2 billion people. Did I say million? Billion.
Yeah.
2 billion people added. Another, you know, 1.5 to 2 billion people are going to move into the middle class. They're going to consume more than double, maybe triple the amount of energy they consumed before they moved in the middle class. So, and we've got these crazy things like AI that are unbelievable energy hogs that are going to keep driving. So humanity is going to keep needing more and more energy. It's the only thing that makes progress possible.
So we still need that rebranding of energy transition to whether it's energy evolution or addition or whatever the case may be, just growth in energy demand. And cleaner energy, I guess, is better for all of us, right? But in the end, it's just we want the energy.
Cleaner energy at the right price.
Right.
Because there's a trade-off. I mean, you know, if you say the cleaner energy is 5 times more expensive, well, I'm not sure that's better for us. Maybe we put 2/5 of that extra in making the, you know, if you say, well, climate change is going to cause this or cause that, well, great, just make our cities more resilient to climate change, you know, adaptation.
Yeah, that's something I've been hearing more about. Yeah, the adaptation.
And that's the problem is I think both camps, the right and the left, tend to polarize the issue, and neither one can really see the other. They both have really good points, and they both have a bunch of stupid points. And the truth is they need to come together in the middle, and we need all the above. We need to be smart about it. In some areas, absolutely solar is the right answer, or wind. Other areas, coal's the right answer. I hate to say it, it is, right? And so
in space, solar is definitely the right answer.
For sure, like or that. Nuclear,
or,
you know.
Or nuclear.
Yeah. Problem with solar in space is you're talking about these gigantic arrays. There's a bunch of space junk out there, not to mention asteroids and everything else. But there's a lot of
too
space
many
junk.
Movies. Asteroids, come on, nothing's gonna.
It's real.
Yeah. All right, so here's a fun one we thought about. What was the first big mistake you learned the most from, and what did it permanently change in your process, in your investing process?
I'd start by answering and say, I make mistakes every day. And as investors, I think that the most important thing you have to be able to do is have the intellectual honesty to admit when you made a mistake. Like, so many times as investors, they try to cover that up. And whether it's investors or capital allocators in companies, it's the worst thing you can do. So first of all, a mistake is just nothing more than an opportunity to learn on how to do something better. You got to kind of frame it as that. In terms of like colossal mistakes, though, you know, we started at Quantum at a very, really good time. I mean, 1998, summer of 98, prices, I think, bottomed in March of 99 at like $10 a barrel and a dollar and change for gas, natural gas. And then over the next decade, you know, prices, basically oil went up, you know, 15-fold, gas went up 10-fold. So pretty good time to be in the business, right?
Not bad.
You could do a whole bunch of things wrong and still make a lot of money. So it was very forgiving. And as the industry, as Shell started to come in 06, we raised our fourth fund. And up until then, we'd never had a deal we lost money on. And I think our track record was something like 130% compounded IRR and like 5 times multiple of money. On our average deal, right?
Solid.
It was crazy, actually. But a lot of that extra outperformance was due to those commodity prices going up. And I think, you know, a lot of things we kind of knew, we got lax on, you know? I think there's 3 big lessons that we learned. In 08, when the whole GFC happened, the world came unglued. It's like, you know, Buffett used to talk about, you know, when the tide goes out, you see who's kind of swimming with no swim trunks on. We had gotten more aggressive in using leverage. Not uber aggressive, but more aggressive. We've gotten less intentional about hedging. And we started to believe that we were pretty smart about, you know, assets, and that although we founded our firm, that it's all about the people, not about the assets. We started taking some risk with assets, and the shales were coming in. Oh, we can do this. And we woke up one morning when we were doing our 08 year-end valuations and had never lost money on a deal before. The largest investment we made was in a shale company. It was great bet. I mean, the guy that was running the largest unconventional company in the United States, we pulled out of Encana to come go start this company. And we wrote that deal down. It was by far the largest, by probably a factor of 2 investment we'd ever made. We wrote it down to about 30 cents on the dollar. And it was really for us that existential moment where like, okay, we quit thinking, and this team was a great team, so we didn't violate there, but we were getting a little sloppy with you know, starting to pick assets over teams, not hedging as much, and using a little too much leverage. And so for us, that was that probably turning point where we just said, fundamental, care how good things are, how smart we think we are, we're always going to pick people over assets. We're always going to hedge. I don't care if oil is $30 a barrel or $100 a barrel when we buy something. We're going to hedge. We're going to hedge systematically. And we're going to maintain very low leverage. Because if you look at the people that got wiped out in every boom-bust cycle, it's the people that aren't hedged, that are over-levered, and they've got mediocre assets and mediocre people running those assets. And so super high-quality assets, great people, hedge, low leverage. And that formula has worked masterfully for us for the last 17 years.
Sounds good. Good advice. I like it. All right. One more. What still feels the most misunderstood about energy investing by people outside the sector, right? Like, we've had less and less. We've had more and more folks leave energy investing, whether it's on the public side or the private side. You know, you have a generalist trying to make a decision on where to deploy capital, whether it's in the public markets or the private markets. You know, is there one thing that you could help people, what will you tell people to help them understand why or what they don't appreciate about what's going on as we go into this next cycle?
Well, there's two camps of people right now, two camps of institutions. There's the camp that energy is horrible, it's broken, it's the worst industry in the world, I want to ever look at it again. To those people, I would say the fact that you and many people think that is the reason it may be the most compelling investment opportunity in the world today, okay, at scale.
Yeah.
And then there's the ones that have been in it and have stayed in it and maybe made some decent money for good reason or bad reason, but did okay. And they're now kind of saying, okay, let's go direct, right? Let's just go direct to these management teams. Let's not go through a Quantum or an NCAP or an NGP or something like that,
okay? Yeah.
And you know, what I would say there is, you know, I'm not saying that we're so good or my peers are so good that have survived, but what I will tell them is this is a really hard business. There's a lot of ways you can make money and there's a lot of ways you can lose money. We've got a whole army of people that tries to help us not lose money and make money. You, institutional investor, have no clue what you're doing. And accountability in any industry or in any business or any relationship is so important. And there's no way you can hold those management teams accountable. And so I would just say to those investors that are kind of, I'll say, getting greedy today is, you know, be careful what you ask for, because, you know, you may have some big winners there, but you're also going to get, it's going to hurt. You're going to unfortunately make some of the big, I mean, you had really proven energy managers, you know, funds that have been in business a long time that couldn't navigate all these, you know, the decisions that had to be made because they're so technical. They're so operationally driven today. Right. I mean, and so I think it's just, depending on which camp you're in, I'd have different answers.
Yeah.
For.
I mean, I do like the idea that so many people don't want to invest in it. Means
yeah.
Now's the time.
Yeah. No, it's
for sure. All right. I'm a little nervous about asking this next question because we didn't really talk about it beforehand. what's one question you have for me?
I think we're at, no, I'm kidding.
and we're at time.
No, actually, okay, one question I have for you. Okay, so you have an interesting position. You're in a company that is, I'd say, on the forefront of information, okay? From the research people you guys have, from the technical people, from the digital, you guys probably have better access to information than anybody else out there in your peer group.
Sure.
And your job, you get to have a lot of conversations with guys like myself and many others. And so I'm curious, I'm gonna ask you two questions.
No, only one.
What's the most, because you're gonna be leaving in Varis here soon. What's maybe your most memorable moment on all of these kind of deals like we're doing today? And what's maybe, I'm gonna say more of a, like, what's the most important insight you feel like you've gained from all these conversations that is not broadly recognized amongst, you know, your customers or the industry, more broadly speaking?
I'm going to go with the second one first because I'm not really sure on the on that first question. I mean, I think as I've thought about, you know, the last 10, 15, 20 years of my career and where I was, you know, as a recent grad, as a recent business school grad, and how I thought about the world then versus how I see the world now, is that you sort of can't race your career. You can't race, like, you know, to the top or where you think you're supposed to be. And everything sort of takes time. Developing relationships takes time. Learning an industry takes a lot of time, especially when you're a history major and not a not an engineer. And you have to be intentional about the way you go and meet with folks and understand what they do versus what the peers and competitors do. And you got to remember, you know, what makes each person tick a little bit. And I feel like there's a much more of a personal element or a human element to what I do, what we do, than people get credit for. It's not all numbers on a screen. It's not all, you know, how the type curve's drawn. I mean, that's important, and you need all that kind of stuff. But I mean, I'm sure you find the same thing. It's about the relationships in the industry and how else would I be able to know the things that I know? How would I be able to get Will Van Lo up on the stage with me, you know, to have this conversation if we didn't take the time to build that relationship? And I think that to me is one of the things that I've learned and, you know, been supported by you know, this team here and like all the great work that everyone's done. Couldn't have done it without them. As for most memorable, I have many memorable moments. I'm not sure I can share all of them here on the stage or should share any of them on the stage. But I think writing Morning Energy, it took different forms and it evolved over time. And it was very antagonistic in the beginning. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things that sort of maybe put me on the radar. People liked that I called it like I saw it. It may have not always gone over well with all of our clients, especially if I was writing about them. But almost all of the time, the criticism was based in some kind of reality that we talked about and, you know, helped them get better at, or it built a stronger relationship over time. Not every time. There's some folks who are still a little, won't talk to me. But that's okay. That's okay. So I think that, you know, that engagement has always been my favorite part.
Well, and you, one of the things I always liked about, you know, your morning notes and stuff, where you did it with some humor, a little bit of, you know, you lightened it up. You had a punchy message, but you softened it a little bit through your wit and humor. So I that's a real skill, and totally second you on the whole relationship thing. I mean, the whole industry runs on relationships, and man, you got to invest in people and build great relationships. And
wow. Well, I appreciate it, and I appreciate our relationship.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
It's an honor to be up here with you today.
Thanks.
On your last
On my last one, yeah. Thank you.
I thought you were going to say that was your most memorable moment.
We're not done yet. We're not done yet. No. We are done, actually. Thanks, everyone, for coming out, Will. Thank you very much.
Thank you.